Why don't you turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 21. We'll actually take all of 21 and actually the first five verses of 22 this morning. Today's date, as you know, is 10-10-10. I haven't heard if any of the planets are aligning or if Nostradamus had said anything. I looked in the news and didn't hear of anything crashing or coming together yet, but we'll wait and see. You know, it was way back on August 5th where we heard about the mine collapsing down in Chile, trapping 33 miners. Yesterday, after day 66, the rescue shaft made it all the way down to the miners, and it's still going to take some time as the families wait at up on deck at what they call Camp Hope, until this escape capsule that they're designing is going to be able to be lowered down to start retrieving the different miners. And this morning, as we watch on from Camp Hope, we have David finding himself temporarily caught in a cave, but we're going to see what happens where this cave all of a sudden becomes more like a tabernacle, more like a sanctuary, a place to be able to meet God. And maybe that'll happen in our lives too, as we'll find ourselves at different times in a cave, all alone, scared, running, in fear. But yet we can see how we can turn those situations around and see how David did, hopefully be able to relate with him in his life. I've entitled our message, David, Israel's Most Wanted. And so we pick it up in verse 1, as a desperate man taking desperate measures. It said, "Now David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest." Remember at the end of chapter 20 from last week, just as a quick reminder, he had just left his friend Jonathan. And sure enough, it was his dad, King Saul, that was in fact trying to kill David. And this was understood. And remember, Jonathan came and shot the arrows. They went past David, which was their signal that it was time to run. It was time to be on the road. And now he takes off, and it's going to be a 10-year run. "Now David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, 'Why are you alone and no one was with you?'" Understand, this is one of King Saul's number one commanders, and all of a sudden he shows up all alone. This is just a very strange situation, and the priest is a little scared. Verse 2, "So David said to Ahimelech the priest, 'The king has ordered me on some business and said to me, do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I send you, or what I have commanded you, and I have directed my young men to such and such a place. Now therefore, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand, or whatever can be found.' And the priest answered David and says, 'There is no common bread on hand, or ordinary bread on hand, but there is holy bread, or consecrated bread. If the young men have at least kept themselves from women.' Then David answered the priest and said to him, 'Truly women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out. The vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessel this day.' And so the priest gave him holy bread, for there was no bread there but the show bread, which had been taken from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away. Verse 7, "Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of the herdsmen who belonged to Saul. And David said to Ahimelech, 'Is there not here on hand a spear or a sword? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste.' And so the priest said, 'The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, there it is, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you take that, take it, for there's no other except that one here.' And David said, 'There is none like it. Give it to me.'" As I said, David lives in exile now for the next 10 years, but we reap some incredible wisdom from this very difficult time in his life. Check this out, Psalm 7, 11, 12, 13, 16, 17, 22, 25, 31, 34, 35, 52, 53, 54, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 64, 142, and 143. Every one of those psalms come out of those next 10 years of experience here. Very difficult in David's day, and you and I get to reap the benefit. Matter of fact, generations have reaped the benefit of this difficult time that he had gone through. Many have found strength and encouragement during their times of testings. Even Jesus Christ on the cross will quote Psalm 22:1 and Psalm 31:5. Even he uses that as something to be able to express his own soul. My God, why have thou forsaken me? Well, this first thing that we have here is an outright lie. He meets the priest and he just a bold-faced lie, and there's no way of making this look any nicer of our man David. But the Bible never flatters its heroes. It tells the truth about them no matter how unpleasant it may be, and so we get to watch on as their whole character is developed. With all the facts, so we might study them. And so we meet God's man in exile, running for his life, destitute of friends, begging bread, lying, before the end of the chapter, pretending madness. You know, we've all been in high altitude before where you've been out of breath. You drive up the mountaintop and you get up there and you walk just a little bit, and pretty soon you're kind of sucking wind a little bit because the air is so thin, this lack of oxygen. You know, it isn't easy walking with God, for the air at that height is somewhat rare. It's pure, but sometimes it's hard to breathe. And faith almost gives up the attempt to keep pace with God's way, with his child. You know, I've been to the lowest elevation on earth, so as some of you, it's the Dead Sea. It's 1,200 feet below sea level, and the oxygen is very nice. It's the opposite of going up to the top of the mountain. It's going below sea level, 1,200 feet, and the oxygen is beautiful there. Very easy to breathe. Many people flock there from all over Europe for this climatotherapy because of the climate that is there. It uses the temperature, humidity, sunshine, the barometric pressure, and everything else. And so they use it for all type of skin diseases and everything else. People flocking down there to this area because the oxygen is so easy to breathe there. But as we see in our Christian life, a lot of times those mountaintop experiences, the air is a little thin. When we're walking God in those mountaintop experiences, sometimes it's not always easy to breathe. Easier to breathe in the valleys. Thin air up there in the mountaintops. This is one of those experiences. Deception. Lying. Proverbs 12:22. Lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, but those who deal truthfully are his delight. It's disappointing to see David to lower himself and to really to depend on lies for protection, because that's what you and I are doing. If we're going to falsify something, if we're going to lie about something, we're no longer trusting in God for our situation there. We're trusting in the lie. We're trusting in, if I say this, if I bend it just a little, just tell a white lie, just fudge just a little bit, then, and that's where we're placing our trust. And our ability to be able to rationalize out of a situation. So he lies to Ahimelech the priest, and he'll lie to Achish the king of Gath. Scripture commands us to tell the truth and warns us of the consequences of lying. Jesus is our example, as Peter said in 1 Peter 2:22. For in him there was no deceit in his mouth. Paul says in Ephesians 4:15, to speak the truth in love. You know, if our telling the truth endangers others, then silence is simply our best response. Here we have David running ahead of God and finding himself in trouble, and thus he lies. And maybe the safest thing to do is to stay away from those situations and to pray, Lord, lead us not into temptation. Well, he comes to the priest where the tabernacle is still set up in Nob. The Ark of the Covenant is still in another place at the time. It'll be later on that David grabs it and brings it to Jerusalem, but it's not there yet. And so he goes to this place, and as was laid out back in Leviticus, every week they would lay out these 12 loaves of bread. It was on a little table called the showbread table, and it was there in the holy place. And then a week later, they would change out that bread. The priests were allowed to eat it, 7 days old, but they were allowed to eat it. And then God would get the fresh hot bread, as it talks about in verse 6 there. So that's the bread that we're talking about. And this whole thing in verse 4 of whether this bread was common, had it just been baked and yet not offered to the Lord yet, or it had already been consecrated? No, it had already been consecrated, but kind of not consecrated anymore because now it's taken off there and it's no longer God's anymore. Now it's his priests that have been consecrated to eat it now. And so, well, maybe you can have it. And that's kind of what the priest is trying to figure out. Would this be okay to do? Jesus talks about this episode in Matthew chapter 12. He also talks about it in Mark and Luke. So it takes three gospels to talk about it. The context was his disciples were walking through a field on the Sabbath, which becomes the key of the story, and they grabbed a handful of grain and they ate of the grain. The Pharisees were peeking in the field from somewhere and saw him do all of this on the Sabbath and confront Jesus about it. The religious leaders of the day had, they know the law had said, don't work on the Sabbath, but what they had come up with was 30 different headings on what that really meant to not work on the on the Sabbath. And four of the headings were reaping, threshing, winnowing, and preparing a meal. Well, what they would do is they plucked it, they would rub it, blow off the chaff, and then eat the grain, which is reaping and threshing and winnowing and preparing. So they hit the top four on the Sabbath. Technically broke all four. Ahimelech gives the bread to David because the higher law of Moses reads that the principle of, you're allowed to act to sustain life. And that's what Jesus was dealing with all of this. Yes, it's a law to not work on the Sabbath. But isn't it better to take care of them? Wasn't the Sabbath made for man, not man for the Sabbath? And that's what he kind of spins the whole situation around. And he refers to this whole incident as an illustration of this compassionate flexibility in the application of Torah's laws. The priest goes, okay, and he gives them the bread and then later asks for it, do you have any weapon? And it's a tabernacle. They normally didn't have weapons, but actually we have the one that you won just a couple miles right down the street from Goliath, and you can have that one. He says, well, that's a good one. It's big. I'll take that one. All the situation taking place, and we get this little parenthesis in verse 7 of a guy named Doeg that happened to show up that day, and he says that he had been detained before the Lord. Now, he's an Edomite, and so he's not really following Jewish principles, but he's here, so maybe he's a proselyte towards Judaism, and he's unclean, and he's here. It doesn't tell us why he's there. A little mysterious. But it's going to say later on in chapter 2, at the very end of the chapter, where David says, gosh, I knew it. I knew when I saw Doeg that day, he'd run back and tell Saul. I knew he would. He worked for Saul. Beware, sin is expensive. Here in David's mind, it's just one little law, one little lie, and I'm going to get this food and take a sword, and it's not going to be that big a deal. One little lie, but sin is expensive. Look at chapter 22, verse 22. So David said to Abiathar, I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house. What will happen, we'll talk next week, there's 86 priests. Saul is so enraged that they would help him out by giving this food. He kills 85 out of the 86. Only one escaped, Abiathar, who will become high priest for David a little bit later on. But that's a situation there. One lie. One lie. Beware, sin is expensive. David could have never guessed that one lie. I'm on a mission from the king, and I had to go really quick, so I don't have any weapons, and don't tell anybody. And he tells us one little lie, and 85 guys get murdered by Mr. Doeg. Well, off David goes with the 5 loaves of God bread and a dead giant's sword. Verse 10 through 15, changed behavior but fixed heart. In verse 10 it says, then David arose and fled that day from before Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. The servants of Achish said to him, Is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of him to one another in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands? Now David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. And so he changed his behavior before them and pretended madness in their hands and scratched on the doors of the gate and let his saliva fall down on his beard. Then Achish said to his servants, Look, you see the man is insane. Why have you brought him to me? Have I need of a madman that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? Another weird episode. And that's the one that that Romulo was talking about, where he changes his behavior here. All of a sudden, he just starts slobbering all over himself and acting just crazy here. First, in verse 10, we have this as he's fleeing before Saul. The fear of Saul temporarily replaces his faith in the Lord. Runs 23 miles away, ends up in Gath. Now, this should be pretty safe. Saul and his men aren't going to, they're probably not going to go. They've always been scared to fight against the Philistine. David was always the one who had to do it, or his son Jonathan. And so, I'll be safe in my enemy territory is what he's thinking. He'll be safe from Saul there. Maybe his friends will be safe back home if he just gets out of Dodge. Fear is always the enemy of faith. To believe God, to rest in his word, to enjoy the promises of God is to conquer our fear. No wonder when fear comes in the door, faith goes out the window. I don't know that you can hold on to both fear and faith at the same time. Fear comes in, faith goes out. Faith goes in, comes in, then fear will go out. I don't know that you can play with both. It's like light and darkness being in the room, light being on at the same time, darkness has to flee. Here we have a good man in bad company. And why does he go there? Why does he go to that extent? It's like Abraham. It's like the children of Israel flying out of Israel to go down to Egypt each and every time. That just always seemed to be wrong. So why does he go to the Philistines here? Maybe we can hate to admit it, but sometimes a persecuted Christian gets better treatment from his enemies rather than from his own Christian friends. It was the king of Judah who imprisoned Jeremiah, and it was the king of Babylon who ended up releasing him. Sometimes, unfortunately, we can look at our backslidden friends and see them back in the world, and we're wondering, why are they back there? Well, you end up talking with them and saying, well, the friends that came alongside me from church said, and then some of the things that they said just embarrassed the heck out of you. It's just like, I'm so sorry. We oftentimes glory in our wonderful gospel of love and mercy to the unsaved, but usually act as if there's no gospel good news for the saint who's been tripped up by the devil. We need to be careful how we handle our friends that are going through something. Handle our friends that are backslidden. Handle our friends that are just getting smacked on by the devil of how to be able to bring them back. James talks about that place of how great it is to be able to go and to be able to win them back. We need to be careful how we do it, that we're not looking down our nose at them and trying to figure out where they're at, try to figure out how to be able to bring them back to that right relationship with Christ and to be able to use gentleness and love in that process. Not to water down the gospel, not to water down his word, not to do any of that, but to be able to care, to be able to love, to be able to show mercy. That's the road home. Let's stop and remember at this particular point, it was God that shot the arrow beyond David. To find him in this situation here, David was going through this whole situation, not because of failure or sin, but simply because of God's purpose in proving the reality of David's love and devotion and faith. This is a time of testing in this man's life. Not that he was into some full-blown carnality. He fell into that. I mean, now it is, but that's not what brought him there. It's not what brought him there. Remember, God is all into the preparing of a man for a throne. And same with the trials and testings that come into your life and my life, because he has a throne for each and every one of us, and he's preparing us for that throne. There's purpose behind all of this. This is all the will of God to make him into the man of God, and you into the man of God, and you into the woman of God that he has designed you to be. I love this quote. It takes a moment to make a convert, but it takes a lifetime to manufacture a saint. It's interesting, in verse 11, they call him David, the king of the land. He's not king yet, but the word had already traveled out. You know, so many people know, his family knows, Samuel knew, and others that were around at the time, and they even considered him that. He was pretty much acting like it at the time, and so, well, but here, David the king, some king, he has no country, no queen, no subjects, no friends. All he has left is his self-respect. And then he loses that too. That goes flying out the window when he fakes his insanity. What an undignified moment in his life, this man that had been anointed by the Spirit of God. How utterly unworthy of his calling was this behavior. But we could probably think of a time where we panicked in God's will and found ourselves acting like a complete fool also. Maybe not to that extent. Maybe didn't let the slobber in your beard. Maybe not to that. But acted like the fool, guilty as charged. Here we have David, from national hero to madman, from pats on the back to now having to look over his back because of the fear of getting stabbed in the back. He is Israel's most wanted. Now even his enemies discard him. I'm sure the question now comes to his mind of family and friends, and now even his enemies discarding him. Would God abandon me? That's got to be what's going through his mind. Matter of fact, I know it is. Explain later. But it's pretty easy to lose your 20/20 spiritual vision at a time like this. It's easy to develop a spiritual squint to see the things in wrong perspective and to start to panic and make bad decisions. But I'm glad the Bible turns the key and opens the door to the inner shrine of this man's life and shows us, yes, a changed behavior, but a fixed heart on God. Really? You look at that and you come on, Brian, where is the fixed heart on God? Well, it's not right here. What happened to David in Gath caused him to acknowledge the inadequacies of his wisdom and brought him to a place where he again placed his confidence in the Lord. That I am 100% sure of from a couple other places. Psalm 56, Psalm 34, Psalm 142 were written right at this exact time right here. Psalm 56 was a cry for help. That's pretty much the chapter, is him crying out to God for help during this time. Psalm 34 was a hymn of praise, obviously God bringing him that mental and emotional and spiritual help during this time. And so he writes out Psalm 34. Would you turn with me to Psalm 34? We're going to kind of touch on all three of those psalms kind of throughout our morning, but right now we'll just look at him crying out in Psalm 34. Again, look at the title. A psalm of David when he pretended madness before Abimelech, who drove him away and he departed. Let me just read verse 4. I sought the Lord and he heard me and delivered me from all my fears. Okay, he sought him. He's praying. He cried out. Look at 6. This poor man cried out and the Lord heard him, saved him out of all of his troubles. 15b, and his ears are open to their cry. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their cry. 17 and 18, the righteous cry out, and the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to those who have a broken heart and saves such as have a contrite heart. You know what he's sharing out of this psalm that took place at that time? We have a man that is realizing, boy, my wisdom sure made me fall right on my face. Look at the lie that's gotten me into this trouble. I give up. And he cries out, he cries out, and he cries out unto the Lord throughout this whole psalm. And he learned that the fear of the Lord is the only thing that will conquer all these other fears. I'm going to run back to Samuel 22 now. We're going to take the first five verses of the next chapter and weave it into our chapter here. Entitled this little section, Noah's Dove and His Motley Crew. In verse 1, David therefore departed from there, Gath, and escaped to the cave of Adullam. So when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. It's only a few miles away from Bethlehem. So he's back in Israel. He's back in the land of Judah, southern Israel. And it says in verse 2, not only his family showed up, but everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. And so he became captain over them. And there was about 400 men with him. Then David went from there to Mizpah of Moab. And so that's on the other side of Israel, on the other side of the southernmost part of the Dead Sea, into what we know as Jordan today, into the land of Moab. And he said to the king of Moab, please let my father and mother come here with you till I know what God will do for me. So he's asking the king here in Moab to grant his family asylum. Now, why would he go to Moab? They're normally, have always been enemies of Israel, but why is David comfortable in doing this? Oh yeah, his great-grandmother is a Moabitess, Ruth the Moabitess. So I'm sure that was kind of family connection there, and it ends up working for him. Verse 4, so he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Now the prophet Gad said to David, do not stay in the stronghold, depart and go to the land of Judah. And so David departed and went to the forest of Hereth. As I had entitled this Noah's Dove and His Motley Crew, the reason I called him Noah's Dove, because David must have felt like Noah's Dove. Let me quote from Genesis 8, 9. Remember Noah on the ark, and he let first the raven go, but raven can, they can land on dead carcasses floating and such. The raven never comes back. And he's waiting to see, is there land out there anyway? So he lets this dove go. It says, but the dove could find no place to set its feet. And so it returned to Noah in the ark. And he reached out his hand and took the dove and brought it back to himself in the ark. And I thought, what a great picture of what's happening in David's life here. He's out there, nothing to land on. He's just completely out. He's ready to fall into the billows, into the waves there. And he's completely tossed on a sea of trials and ready to drop into this helpless waves. And then the ark presents itself. And a hand graciously reaches out and rescues him. He finds himself here in verse 1 of chapter 22 in the cave of Adullam. Again, just a couple miles south of the scene of where David had triumphed over Goliath. And again, pretty close, is 15 miles from Bethlehem, his hometown. There's a hill there about 500 feet high. It's pierced with numerous of these honeycomb caverns, some of them as large as you could put 200 to 300 men in these caverns in there today. At least now he's in friendly territory. We obviously learn that being a person after God's own heart doesn't mean never experiencing the darkness of a cave. Rather, it means to be able to trust that God's light is there and He is the God of all hope. Here is where I'm going to turn to Psalm 142, where he composed Psalm 142. As it says, is the intro to Psalm 142, a contemplation of David, a prayer when he was in the cave. In the cave. I'll just especially note, I'm going to read just excerpts of 3 and 4. My spirit was overwhelmed within me. End of verse 3. They have secretly set a snare for me. Beginning of 4. Look on my right hand and see there is no one who acknowledges me. And then the pit of it all, at the end of verse 4. No one cares for my soul. What happens is that this cave becomes his holy tabernacle, where faith could find shelter under the wings of the cherubim in the Holy of Holies. That's Psalm 57:1, where David wrote that one in a cave, probably a different cave, but he finds himself under the shelter of his wings, meaning that Ark of the Covenant and the two giant angels made of gold that were above the Ark of the Covenant, and which represents where God dwelt, and he found himself kind of tucked into that, right in the presence of God. And so here he is in the midst of this dark and dingy and dank cave, and yet all of a sudden it becomes that place that's like a tabernacle, because God is there. What looked like a cave to others becomes his divine sanctuary. And in Psalm 142:5, he says, God, you are my refuge and my portion. But as a cave can be a place of respite for a time, we should not use it as an excuse to become cave dwellers, barricading off the entrance to our lives and not letting anyone else inside. Are you a cave dweller sometimes? What threatening enemies usually force you into a place of hiding? Where do you most often retreat? Where is your cave of Adullam? And one more question, when does a cave become a prison? See, if that cave is a place to be able to kind of refocus and realize where you are, realize your failures, realize you need God and His wisdom in your situation, that cave becomes a beautiful, beautiful place. But when you block the entrance and keep everybody else out and won't take help from anybody, and you pretty soon just become a recluse and you find comfort in your little cave, just you and your cave, that's when it becomes wrong. At this place is where God brings his family to him. Those same brothers that stood ahead of him in line, hoping to be anointed by Samuel, stood in front of him in line. Now they're standing behind him, supporting him in his greatest time of need. God not only brought his family to him, it says, but he brought this motley crew. 400 men who looked to David for leadership. His own little Tea Party movement, if you will. And with them, we have this group of those that were in distress, some that were in debt, and some that were discontented. Three groups of D's, distressed. Those that were staggering under great pressures and stresses. They can relate to a leader like David going through these same things. You know, spiritually, there's no self-satisfied man that ever comes to Christ. It's when God usually brings a person to the end of themselves is when they turn to Christ. A self-satisfied man gives, well, we have a whole church full of them in Revelation chapter 3. It's the church where Jesus is standing outside of the door of the church and knocking. They're known as the church that thought themselves rich and increased with goods and in need of nothing. It's when a person or a church gets to that place. Why would they come to Christ? They don't need Christ. They got it all figured out. They got it all handled. No, it's sheer distress that drove the prodigal son back to his father. It was sheer distress that would bring these guys to David. It's sheer distress that will bring us to a relationship oftentimes with Christ. But not all were in that category. Others were in the category of simply drowning in debt due to Saul's heavy taxation. But spiritually, we find ourselves also at that place, hopefully. Bankrupt, wretched people. Apart from grace, we find ourselves bankrupt and insolvent, desperately in spiritual debt and helpless to meet God's judgment. And therefore, our only hope is to fly to the wounded side of our Lord Himself. Third group was discontented. This other group sought out their national hero who had been similarly abused and, well, spiritually today, many are embittered and disappointed and frustrated and just restless. And yet instead of running to Christ, they gather around the world's broken cisterns, trying to satisfy their thirst, for they know not what. And yet Jesus comes along and says, if any man thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Then out of his life shall flow rivers of cool and living water. David becomes that. Jesus, to be in the generations of David to come, great, 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 great grandson of David here, as they flocked to David, so one day they would flock to the Messiah that would come from his loins. David welcomed these men and provide a godly leadership that they needed. He'll even say, and again in Psalm 34:11, he makes a statement, come my children and listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Isn't that great? That's what he's writing. Again, that Psalm 34, during the midst of that, which sounds strange. If you're just reading that psalm, what children? Well, he's got 400 of them now. Come, my children, listen to me, and I'll teach you what? The fear of the Lord. See, because I got caught up in the fear of man, the fear of Saul, the fear of Achish, and just on the run and everything else. And I learned the only way to replace those fears is the fear of the Lord. You know what? God may not bring 400 guys to your front doorstep, and you're probably saying, good. But he may bring someone who is in a similar situation to simply be able to say, I understand what you're going through. God's gracious and does that. As cancer patients have found a new reason to live by reaching out to other cancer patients. Alcoholics and the strength to stay sober by helping other recovering alcoholics. Victims of abuse find the hope to endure by ministering to other victims of abuse. And so a lot of times, he'll bring others alongside of you, which you'll do one of two things. Commiserate together, just woe is me, yeah, woe is me too. I have a bad situation, yeah, mine's even worse, you know. And you just take each other down to the pit of despair. Or it's one that comes alongside saying, I'm going through the same thing. But here's what God's showing me. But here's what he's doing in my life. But here's what I've been able to hold on to. Here's one scripture that's been my promise. It's been my lifeline to God, where he can just continues to give me nourishment. Maybe it'll help you too. Check out this verse. David's darkest hour, God gave him a ministry of helping men like him. Isn't that interesting? A lot of times I'll do that. People come in for counseling and they're just in their pit. They're in their woes. And I'll say, have you ever thought of getting your eyes off yourself and onto somebody else? It'll help. Watch. How about showing up on Wednesday night and helping out with our feeding ministry? How about you're just stuck in this mode? I can see you're just spinning and spinning and all that's wrong in your life. How about get out of it just for a second and minister to somebody else? It'll feel pretty good. And you'll realize that you don't have it the worst on planet Earth. You realize that there's others struggling too. You find out that, well, that's what's happening with David. In his darkest hour, God says, I got some ministry for you to do. Take care of these 400 guys. You know, you would think it'd be at a time where he's like, I can't even take care of myself. Look at the stupid thing that I just did in chapter 21. And yet in this cave of Adullam, the Lord shows up and says, now I got some ministry for you to do. I want you to minister to these men who also had been broken down by different injustices. Their spirits could easily have been soured like rotten milk, fermenting into calls for a violent revolution. But David kept his eyes on God. So that's what they could have been, 400 guys going, let's take Saul. Let's take Saul. You're supposed to be the next king anyways. Let's go. But David keeps his eyes on God and instills in these men character and direction for their lives and turns them into mighty warriors, it says in 1 Chronicles chapter 11. These are and become David's mighty men. And this 400 becomes 600 in a short amount of time. Begin. How does this all take place? How do you go from this lonely desperation to this God-entrusted leadership? Well, again, the three psalms clue us in. Psalm 142, Psalm 57, Psalm 34. They reveal the attitude that made change possible. Folks, that's the answer right there. The attitude that made the change possible. You go back and you just read that, where finally he gets a hold of, okay, I can't lean on my wisdom. Okay, I can't just stay in this pit of depression. Okay, I can't stay at this. I need to cry out unto the Lord. And those three psalms, they're the answer. That's how to go from, to get from here to there. Let's wrap up with this. David is now undergoing a most essential part of all of his training, which would qualify him to pass on maybe just this one thing to his cave-dwelling buddies. One more time, Psalm 34, and I'll end here. Psalm 34, verse 8. If he only learned this, if he was only able to pass on this one little verse, I think it would have been worth it all. Psalm 34, 8, you've heard it before. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who trusts in him. I think you need that this morning, and I think I need that this morning. Because whatever comes our way, it's what I try to do at memorial services. It's what I try to do in counseling appointments when somebody is just in the funk of depression, is help them to be able to taste. It might only be a little nibble. It might only be a lick on the tongue. But that they would be able to taste and see God is still good in your circumstance and in your situation. Oh, would you just taste and see? Would you just nibble on God? Because he's still good. Oh, how happy, how blessed is the man who places his trust in him. Maybe you find yourself in Camp Hope this morning, praying and hoping for some family member down in a dark, deep cave. Maybe you find yourself in the cave of Adullam. Maybe you find yourself in distress or in debt or discontent this morning. And I would simply say, oh, taste and see that the Lord, he is good. Blessed are you if you will take your refuge in him. Amen? Good Psalms.